Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkilt.
It's Thursday, May 30th from HBR2. It's The Conversation. Patient presents with classic contagious invoiceitis.
Visualize world music.
Why the difference? Our kaka'ako or yours?
Whining for your honey. Mother Mead comes to Kauai.
Plus, Deutsche Welle has the world report. We've got a mule path in the backyard and ethically expensive tickets in today's reality check.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Same service, different cost. That troubling reality is a fact for consumers who have procedures at hospitals in Hawaii and around the country. The menu of medical services doesn't have a set price tag. The bill for an appendectomy at one hospital may greatly vary from the one down the street. George Green says the reason is simple. We just have to look in the mirror. George Green is president and CEO of Healthcare Association of Hawaii, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Hi there.
Good morning.
Let's explain that last part, because you wrote an op-ed a couple weeks ago where you detailed the facts that you can't just have some, you know, set menu for services. Everything is very much dependent upon the individual and what happens as things are in process during a procedure.
Right. It depends on the actual person and the care that they're receiving. You know, the term that I used in the op-ed is that we're not selling, or a hospital is not selling, a Big Mac. One broken leg does not look like another broken leg. There may be complications associated with one broken leg that are not associated with another. That person may be admitted, and he or she may be found to have additional comorbidities, which have to be addressed while they're in the hospital. So it's really hard to take a look at one case and compare it to another, because you have to look at the individual and the actual circumstances of their case when looking at the costs associated with the services that are provided to that individual.
So when people say, well, those prices should be a little bit more transparent, doesn't that mean that we need to have maybe a range of costs that people would be given so they can make an informed choice?
Well, I think with the information that has been published by CMS recently, people will be able to go online and start to take a look at different prices and different costs. At the Healthcare Association, we have entered a dialogue with our members to discuss billing and costs and reimbursement, and begin to figure out what direction we would like to go as an industry here in Hawaii as far as putting out additional information. We recently had a meeting with a partial group of our acute care CEOs to begin that dialogue, and our next steps are going to be having some discussions with our chief financial officers from the hospitals and looking at models across the country to figure out what needs to be part of that information, whether it be looking at the charity care hospital policies of hospitals, or looking at what information should be included in the public information that is distributed. Because when we've looked at some different models, they seem to focus in on price, but there are really three areas. There's the price, there's the cost, and then there's the reimbursement, and they're all very different issues.
When you met with some of these acute care CEOs last week, that was after you wrote the op-ed on May 15th. Were they particularly sensitive to some of these issues in a different way now than they have been, say, 3 or 6 months ago?
I wouldn't say that they're more sensitive to the issues. These issues have always been in existence. I think that they realize that this is an issue that, again, is very complex. And over the years, there have been multiple attempts to try and explain these issues to consumers. And I think that they've just realized that we're going to have to redouble our efforts to try and explain this complex issue.
It's interesting that you use the word consumers, because once upon a time we would have said just patients. But over the last several decades, the issue of becoming more of a consumer of all kinds of services, including medical services, plus the pressure from insurers to have a more, you know, proactive stance in your own health care, has changed how people regard what they do when they see a doctor or when they go to see a doctor, perhaps how they choose an obstetrician. I mean, really looking at it from a consumerist perspective, isn't that a good thing?
I think it is. I think as a patient or as a consumer, you always have to take a look at, number one, who's providing the best quality. And here in Hawaii, all of our providers are providing very high quality health care. And then number two, you always have to take a look at what makes the most sense for you financially.
Given the fact, though, that this has been a movement in process for a long time, George, didn't people in the healthcare industry anticipate that one of the first things that consumers were going to want to know about would be price?
I think that they have always, again, realized that the whole billing, cost, and reimbursement issue was a complex one. And again, I know that there have been attempts in the past to explain this issue. And again, with its complexity, I think that it's something that is really hard to digest by consumers or patients, because most people, when they go in for any sort of service, they basically look at a bill, and they look at that bill, and those are their charges, and so that is really what they focus in on. What consumers and patients don't realize is that hospitals are providers of care. It's not the same situation as, say, you go into, let's say you're going to buy a car, which is an example that I often use. When you go in to buy a car, a consumer is a consumer, and a consumer can negotiate that price for that car to a certain extent, but the car dealer always has the final say as to how much they're going to sell that car for.
Right, and clearly with a hospital, they have their costs and they know what their reimbursement is, and they may be there as a nonprofit, but they still have to be able to cover their costs. And we know that those reimbursements that you talked about a little earlier for Medicare and Medicaid are going to be changing, so this is not going to get any less complex.
That's right.
mean now for people who are really stuck and who are looking at bills and they don't necessarily know everything that bill means, or they may find an error on that bill?
Well, the good news is that all facilities have patient advocates and billing professionals who will work with patients to not only explain those bills, but in the cases where they cannot afford to pay those bills, they will work with them depending on what their financial situation is. But what I was referencing or alluding to earlier is that over 60% of the consumers of healthcare are Medicare and Medicaid. And with regard to that patient population, hospitals have no say as to what their reimbursement will be. Whether it's the Medicare or Medicaid, they set their payment scales, and those payments are below the cost of hospitals, and hospitals have no say-so.
No, but that means that they have to pick up the cost someplace else, don't they? Otherwise,
right.
They're going to be out of pocket.
That's right. And even when you look here in Hawaii, let's focus in on Hawaii. If you look at Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial payers, Hawaii hospitals on average are still receiving about 10% less than cost in reimbursement. And one of the things that I think people don't understand is that hospitals on a continual basis have to go out and seek charitable contributions. And on average, without those charitable contributions, hospitals would lose on all of the care that they provide.
George, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment. I know you have more meetings scheduled with providers, and we'll be checking in with you to see how this develops. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
George Green is president and CEO of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii and represents the continuum of care in our state from providers to hospitals. And as you heard, this is a developing story, and we'll continue to follow what happens and what it means for you and your hospital bill.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Next up, your quiz, and later, peace on earth when it's far from Christmas, and tickets that may cost lawmakers more than they're worth.
Honolulu's downtown has a true skyline, a cityscape full of mirrored glass and concrete towering over the streets below. But once, Honolulu was a small town huddled around a harbor. Before the 1960s construction boom, when it said that the crane was the state bird, most buildings rose only two or three stories, making the 10-story Aloha Tower the tallest building in town. As the skyline has changed, so too have the streets that now accommodate the giant corporate centers and condos. Alakea Street in Honolulu's business district was once a towpath from Honolulu Harbor. If you took a trip into the city's past, you'd see mules pulling ships over the harbor's sandbar. The mules labored over a surface that was neither asphalt nor dirt. The Hawaiian to English translation of the compound word formed from the meanings of ala and kea would give you a hint in answering today's question. And so, for today's backyard quiz, can you name the material that once formed the towpath?
Aloha, I'm Paul Mitri, the chair of the Department of Theater and Dance at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned to HPR 2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Performing artists do what they can to support the causes they believe in, and they're lucky, in a way, to have a gift to share through benefit concerts. Keith Haugen and his wife Carmen, longtime Hawaii entertainers, have enlisted a group of like-minded friends again this year for the 7th annual Peace on Earth concert. This one's at the Hawaii Theater, with the artists giving their time for the fight against kidney disease and lupus, and Keith is with us this morning. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, it is kind of a benefit of being a performer, don't you think, to be able to say, okay, I'll do a show for this purpose and raise some money that you might not be able to just write a check for.
It is. And, you know, over the years since we started this, we called on a lot of our friends to come in and perform. And each show is different every year. But the Kidney Foundation 3 years ago decided they wanted to be a part of this. And they came in and started helping. And what they've done is offer an honorarium to the performers, mm-hmm. because they also feel that we shouldn't all donate our time all the time, mm-hmm. you know. So it's kind of nice, but it's impossible to pay all these performers what they're worth, but they do go home with something in their
pocket.
Little
bus fare, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's more the gesture than anything else, but from the performers, it's a gesture from them, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And in fact, you know, being an entertainer, and you can appreciate this, we're asked often to perform, and we rarely say no.
Yeah.
If it fits in our schedule, we go out and perform for many worthwhile causes around town.
I think it's one of the privileges, don't you?
I do, too. I think so. And, you know, everybody in the community should contribute something to the community. And this is one way that entertainers can do it that most others cannot.
Well, you know, there's so many problems in society that seem insoluble or daunting at best, and you frequently hear, what can I do? But the answer is always something, isn't there?
There is. And in the case of entertainers, they've got something special to offer because people want to hear them, and they're willing to come out and spend an evening enjoying the music or something. They contribute something that nobody else in town can contribute.
Yeah, and you're offering, it's not a trip to the dentist. It's an evening of entertainment, right?
Actually, no, I like going to the dentist because when I leave, I'm always in better shape than when I went in.
Well, I'm always glad it's over, too.
Yeah.
Well, who are your fellow performers this year?
Well, every year we kick off our concert with an orchestra, a big band, if you will, led by our son Stanton. And every year except one we missed, we were in a facility where they wouldn't allow the big band. But that's a big come on, and people ask us to repeat it. They want a Hanaho, they like that band. So we put them on for like 40 minutes at the beginning of the concert, doing big band music, jazz music, classical, you name it, you know, a real variety. And this year we're following that with Gary Iko and the Islanders. Gary's a very prominent entertainer in Waikiki for more than half a century. And
sure.
Eldest son of Hawaiian music icon Antiginoa Keawe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's joined by Alana Kaka and Kaipua Singh. And then the Carmen Haugen Quartet, which is a regular feature in every concert. We go on after that. And after an intermission, we're turning the entire second half of the evening over to Willie Kay, which is like a dream come true for us to get Willie to be our headliner. He's one of the biggest draws in Hawaii and one of the greatest entertainers I've ever heard anywhere. And so having Willie Kay is a huge plus for us this year.
One of the things that Willie brings to the table is amazing versatility, doesn't he?
Yes. There isn't anything he can't do. I always describe him as the greatest all-around entertainer, because you might have a particular artist that you like that sings well, or a good musician, or a good comedian, or something, but Willie encompasses every aspect of entertaining. He's just a consummate performer.
Well, you know, given that you and Carmen are the producers, that sends a signal to a lot of people that it's going to have an emphasis on the traditional and the done right.
Thank you.
Is that an accurate characterization? I don't think that's
that is.
That's not an exaggeration.
We,
I think.
Throughout the year, we listen to other performers, some we've known for many years, some we've never heard, and we select people who are going to be in the next concert. And that's one of the things that we're always concerned with. We want to have it done right.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're doing Hawaiian, we pick acts to do Hawaiian correctly. If we pick jazz, we pick someone who's very prominent in the field of jazz. Last year, our headliners were Janai and Pierre Grill.
There you go.
The year before, our headliner was Dennis Kamakahi.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who are well known and well recognized by their peers and by the public. And we're just thrilled that they will come in and be a part of our evening.
When you say Hawaiian music done right, and you've always been an advocate for that, music and language done right, why is that important, Keith?
Well, it's important because so few people can share what is done right. It's easy to copy someone else, and even those who are emulating a great performer or something oftentimes don't have the command of the language or the knowledge of the music. Right now, we're very lucky to have an awful lot of good musicians who are specializing in slack key guitar, for instance, or mm-hmm. ukulele and so on. And they might be great at what they're doing, but not terribly Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want something Hawaiian, we're going to look specifically for someone who is. But a lot of times we include things that are totally out of the Hawaiian genre for our concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had country, we've had classical, we've had just about every type of music in there. And for instance, we're hoping one year to have Jake Shimabukuro, even though he doesn't play a lot of Hawaiian music, but he's certainly a genius on that ukulele.
Isn't he, though? Yeah.
He's probably the best known performer from Hawaii. I hear, in terms of exposure to the world and that, I mean, his name rings a bell right up there with Kamehameha Nui and Kalakaua and Don Ho and Alfred Apaka, you know.
Keith, the common thread, I mean, when you say you want Hawaiian done right, if you want country, you want it done right, but mm-hmm. the common thread being done right.
That's right. Thank you.
That's kind of your curatorial function.
It is.
You and Carmen. But at the same time, I think you're in a position to promise that, given the people that you've got, don't you?
We are. We're in a wonderful position to do that, and with the help of the Kidney Foundation backing us there, they say, you know, give us the best that you can get.
Yeah.
And this year, we were very fortunate. We didn't ask Willie. Willie asked the Kidney Foundation if he could be a part of their program. He wanted to be a spokesman for the Kidney Foundation, and he wanted to perform, and so we grabbed him right away and made him the headliner.
And that's exactly what we were talking about earlier, Keith, the whole mm-hmm. the performer's privilege, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to get someone of Willie's stature who's willing to come in from Maui and spend a couple days in Honolulu to do a concert. And we really don't care what kind of music Willie does.
It'll be good, no question.
He can do opera, he can do jazz, he can do blues, he can do country, he can do Hawaiian. Whatever he wants to do,
surprise me, right, Keith? Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on the show this morning.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Keith Haugen and his wife Carmen are the producers and two of the performers at the 7th Annual Peace on Earth Concert, June 7th at the Hawaii Theater in downtown Honolulu. Learn more from our website, hpr2.org.
If you like ukulele lady, ukulele lady like you. If you like to linger where it's shady, ukulele lady lingers too. If you kiss an ukulele lady while you promise ever to be true, and she sees another ukulele lady fool around with you, maybe she'll sigh. Somebody else by and by to sing to when it's cool and shady.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
You gotta get an internship to get a paying job, but new graduates considering unpaid internships maybe shouldn't.
Students are basically receiving a negative wage. It's worse than working for free. They're actually paying to work.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Unpaid internships aren't all they're cracked up to be. You know, the story next time on Marketplace from APN.
This evening at 6, following Town Square. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Gerald Sada of Aiea, Wesley Odani of Honolulu, and Peggy Umetsu of Mililani for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's now 8:28, and you're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. The State Ethics Commission says University of Hawaii officials have been violating the ethics code by giving free tickets for expensive athletic events to family members. So, what are they going to do about it? CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair is back with today's reality check. Hey, Chad. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you, Beth Ann. Good to be back.
Well, it looks like we're all going to learn a new phrase in this ongoing controversy. Legitimate state purpose. That's going to become the litmus test, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And first, let me just step back a moment and say, here we are again with a problem with ethics and UH athletics and officials. But
it's deja vu all over again.
I know. Not quite as severe as what was going on with the Wonder Blunder and all that sort of thing. But yesterday, the Hawaii Ethics Commission met, and what they did is they said, you've got to change this policy on giving out UH event tickets. Apparently, there have been a number of violations giving free tickets to these big events. And you mentioned what is legitimate state purpose. Well, the ethics code specifies when you can give that out. Let me give you a couple of examples. If you're promoting something with the university, if you're recognizing a guest at a ceremony, if there's a corporate sponsorship or a donorship involved, these are considered legitimate purposes, not just giving it to your auntie or your cousin or your friend just because you're a UH official.
Yeah, because most likely those family members likely have goodwill for the university anyway. That's not the point. The goodwill is supposed to be extended to other people who may not have that kind of understanding of what the university is all about, and bringing them to an event and showing them something extends the reach of the university and hopefully the reach into not only just, you know, people's goodwill, but pocketbooks too.
Exactly. And so there'll be a memo that'll spell out all the details. Interestingly enough, they will exclude the types of people who have already been receiving these kind of passes. Just to let you know, UH Regents, the president, the Manoa chancellor, they're allowed two free tickets, one for themselves and one for their significant others. And they do get a break on purchasing reserved area tickets for immediate family members. But other than that, there's some pretty strict guidelines that you have to follow. So that will be going into effect shortly. Well, just in time for the football season, I suppose.
And everybody will get to see it because it's going to be posted, right?
Exactly. It'll be up on the ethics page website. I'm certain they're pretty good at keeping all those policies online.
All right. So no excuse. That's the bottom line. Thanks, Chad.
Sure, Beth Ann. See you tomorrow.
You bet. Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook. This half hour, get thee to a meadery. Tonight at 5 on Town Square, Beth Ann, you're going to be looking at some new educational models, including changes to the physical setting, yeah?
Especially changes to the physical setting, and not just in classrooms, but workspaces, too. There is some different thinking about how we work and how we learn best, and that has a lot to do with our physical environment.
Well, classrooms have been in orderly rows with the teacher up front for quite some time now.
And then we kind of had this modular thing going on for a while, and it's undergone a lot of different points of view and different theories and ways of being. But some of the latest now is what we're going to take a look at tonight on Town Square. And we're going to be talking with Mahina Hugo, head of school at La Pietra, and also Bettina Maynard, the COO of Architects Hawaii, about what they're actually doing in classrooms and workspaces that you might just find yourself in at a point in time.
So in a way, the changes in the physical setting reflect a kind of a change in a philosophical approach to learning, yeah?
Don't they always?
Well, one would hope.
Well, we're going to find out exactly what that means, because a lot of brain research over the last couple of years has talked about how kids learn better, how people focus better on their work, how do you increase productivity, all of that. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're sitting in nice, orderly little rows with your hands folded on the table if you're a kid.
I guess that isn't how life works, as we've learned. Thanks very much, Beth Ann. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Kaka'ako is it anyway? That's the central question some concerned residents are asking about the plan to revitalize their neighborhood. The latest proposal includes several high-rises that proponents say are necessary to create the trendy and sustainable live-work-play lifestyle. And you may remember we talked about that a little bit yesterday. Well, today we're going to take a look at what it means for the residents who are there, who know that even if it means that fewer cars are on the road, density is not necessarily on their agenda. They'd like to keep the skyline just the way it is. Thank you very much. Tonight, Representative Scott Psyche will help host a meeting at the state capitol. He joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Yesterday, we did talk about how there has been a facelift happening in Kaka'ako. All very nice. Nothing that you can look at and say, well, gee, that's terrible, unless maybe you don't like those colors or you don't like graffiti painting. But talking about high-rises and changing a skyline and the whole issue of what density means for an area, that's where some of the residents that you've been talking to are having some issue, are they not?
Right. I think that the general concern at this point is that Kaka'ako may become overbuilt, and that it may end up looking like Hong Kong. And that's something that I think residents want to avoid, both residents as well as those who work in the area. And it should be a concern for, all residents in the urban core of Honolulu as well as the rest of the island.
So how does that sync with the movement that we've seen across the country and other places around the world to move people back to the urban core? I mean, once upon a time, the idea was to get into a suburb, and now here we are on the other side of the pendulum trying to move back to the urban core and create a that you know live work play model so that you don't have to use a car all the time.
Right. I suspect that that the public is in support of development in Kakako so that because proximity and those kinds of issues are important for people. The concern, though, is that whether or not there's a potential for it to be overbuilt. Height and density issues are a big concern right now. For example, the HCDA is proposing that perhaps three 700-foot towers could be built in the area. And this is, they were proposing a 650-foot tower, so today it's now a three 700-foot towers. And those would be built, under exemptions from the current HCDA development rule. So I think that while the public does generally support balanced development, Kakako should not be overbuilt.
So like that Pohukaina project that you just mentioned, well, at least one of the towers would be too high, but what would be then acceptable if you know you've got to build it a little bit more densely? What's the happy medium?
Well, the current height limitation is 400 feet, which is approximately 40 floors. I know that the counter argument is that a higher building would create more open space, the numbers would pencil out better for developers. But I think once you start to raise buildings to that level, it creates bad precedent for the entire community. I think the question really is, and I'm not sure what the answer is, but how many buildings are sufficient? How many high-rises are adequate for this area? I'm not sure if the HCDA has answered that question.
They say that there could be maybe six or seven high-rises in the plan, but that's a big maybe. All of this is sort of on the drawing board, and we don't know whether this is going to happen or not, which is in part why you're having this meeting tonight. If they do go through, do you see any compromise happening there? Maybe not, five or seven of them, but maybe two, three, even if they have to be a little higher than, 450 feet?
Well, I think collectively, when you look at all of the preliminary plans, there could be the potential for over 20 high-rises being built in this area. Not all at 700 feet, but I would think most of them are going to be at the 400-foot level. So, and those are preliminary proposals, which haven't yet gone before the HCDA. I'm not sure exactly where those towers are going to be, so I don't want to kind of get into a balancing of numbers or that kind of game at this point, because we don't even know, and this is one of the issues, is that I don't think all of the concrete plans have been presented to the public yet for the public to review and comment on.
When the HCDA director was here yesterday, Anthony Ching was talking about it in those single-digit numbers, the five or the six or the seven that are on or in the plan or could be in the plan. And the idea of preserving green space, having mixed use, mixed income, being able to be close to restaurants and fun, and really that this is an area that might well be for the young and the fun, is very much part of how this is being revitalized. Is that how a lot of the residents also see part of what this plan does, bring back young people and a sense of vitality to the area?
Right. I'm sure that, I'm sure that residents, and I would agree that the area needs to be modernized. And it needs to be, updated and revitalized. But the question is, how do you mitigate the impact, not just for residents and those who work here now, but for those outside of the area who, in Makiki and in Nu'uanu, in the surrounding areas, how do you mitigate the impact? So, for example, the city has not yet done a traffic study for the potential development in this area. And I know that the premise is that, well, people will walk and ride their bikes, but people are still going to have cars. And how is the traffic going to be impacted with all this development? So there are some agencies that are normally included in the land use process that are excluded from this HCDA process. And I think it's important to bring these kinds of agencies back into the fold and to have their comments.
Specifically, who has been excluded?
Well, the county land use requirements are exempted. So the traffic study, for example, there would be comments, but it's not a part of the formal process. Even the Department of Education recently sent a letter indicating that there may not be sufficient classroom capacity for the development in this area.
Well, I know you're going to have a meeting later on this evening, and we'll check back with you to hear what residents have to say about it. And obviously, it's only a plan at this point, nothing that's been done with dried ink. So we'll see how Kaka'ako develops.
Yeah, and I just wanted to emphasize that we want to be very positive in how we deal with HCA. We want to help improve their decision-making process so that they make the best decisions for this area.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Bethan.
State House Majority Leader Scott Sike represents District 26. He and other lawmakers are inviting members of the Kaka'ako community to a meeting later on this evening at 5 at the Capitol. And when he's not in session, he practices law at Gallagher, DeRobertis, and Ono. The current plan for Kaka'ako, at least the one that's on the drawing board, is on our website, hbr2.org.
Today in the backyard, we consider the time before Hawaii's capital became the grass and concrete not-quite jungle of 2013. Once, Alakea Street in downtown Honolulu served as a towpath from the harbor. The mules that pulled the ships into harbor moorage are long gone, and so too is the towpath that is now known as Alakea Street. But before it was paved in asphalt, the road for mules was covered with a different substance, and today we asked you to name it. If you know the language of the host culture or picked a Hawaiian dictionary in the last 20 minutes, you know that ala means pathway and kea means white. And what could create that pathway? A homegrown gravel, white coral. That's today's backyard quiz, with thanks to our favorite tutu for sending it in. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Heidi Smith from the Department of Health, the Healthy Hawaii Initiative. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
When King Arthur and his knights roistered after dinner at the Round Table, or when Robin Hood and his merry men celebrated after putting one over on the Sheriff of Nottingham, what do you think they drank? Mead, arguably the mother of all alcoholic beverages. It's wine made from honey, and it's more than just booze. Many are the legends and stories associated with mead, and Stephanie Krieger from Nani Moon Meadery on Kauai is on the phone from Kapaa to tell us more. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Mead is, I'm getting the feeling it's more than just a liquid, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful. It's nectar of the gods.
Well, the whole idea of wine made from honey, for most people who hear that, that's really all they need to hear, yeah?
Yes and no. Sometimes when people hear that wine made from honey, they think, they automatically assume it's a sweet beverage.
Uh-huh.
And, there are so many different styles of mead out there, just as many styles as there are wine and beer. So that's one of the major misconceptions of mead.
Well, how would you characterize what it tastes like? Is there a way to sort of define it?
Well, there are so many different profiles, again. And when you talk about the ancient European days, the more traditional meads were made very thick with honey and water, and they were very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the ages and the thousands of years that mead has been in existence, different cultures have added their own styles. So mead, in addition to honey, can be fermented with fruits and spices and even beer ingredients. So it has so many different, each style can have such a different profile from the next.
What do you folks specialize in?
Well, we specialize in Hawaiian meads. Our focus is 100% locally sourced honey and fruits and spices from our independent farmers and beekeepers here on Kauai and in Hawaii. And we have several different styles. Our styles are dry and fruit-forward. Then we do have some spiced varieties and also some semi-sweet varieties.
What kind of reactions do you get from, you know, people who come in and don't even know what it is?
Well,
I assume there are such people, right?
There are, most of them.
Yeah.
It's surprising. The clientele that comes in that really knows about mead usually has an interest in the craft brew community.
Uh-huh.
So those who are interested in craft brews usually have more of a knowledge in mead, maybe because they've experimented with it in their home brewing styles. But it's really education one person at a time. So I basically just go over that basic definition that honey defines all meads, that any mead will always have honey. But we always start with letting people know that ours are created more in the style of a wine
mm-hmm.
and crafted in a way that can be enjoyed in Hawaii's climate with our cuisine, the tropical fruit-forward characteristics in some of our varieties. Really lend a nice characteristic to our regional cuisine. And then we do have the semi-sweets that are more for those people who really like that traditional style.
Stephanie, you alluded to the craft brew community. Tell me, there is such a community?
Yes, there is. You know, those who are interested in microbrews and you know, the beer style in general. And I've noticed when I started creating these meads about 13 years ago, I really did it with the premise of making them more in the style of a wine, you know, a product that could be enjoyed on the table just like any other fine wine here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found in the past few years is that my clientele that comes in that is really excited about mead really are those in the craft brew community. And, you know, for example, we participate in the Kona Brew Fest, and we've been there for the past 3 years. We have such a great support system there. We have such a great following. And so it's interesting how, even though I started with this intent to focus on a wine-style mead, that those who are into the craft brews and the beer have such a great interest in my product.
Well, that's great that you have a ready-made audience, isn't it?
It is, and it's growing.
Well, you know, Stephanie, the whole, you allude, I think it's on your website, that you allude to the whole kind of the mystical origins of mead, which goes back longer than any other recorded alcoholic beverage, right?
It's true.
And you were sort of linking it to the whole origin of the honeymoon, which is something I hadn't known about.
Yes, well, you know, that's something that I discovered once I started making meads in my garage, was that legend of the honeymoon and its link to mead. And if you Google honeymoon and mead, you will find so many different variations on that legend.
What is the legend? Can you sort of sum it up for me?
Yeah, the summary is basically, you know, back in the ancient days where mead was the primary alcoholic beverage of choice, when a couple were to get married, they would enjoy mead or honey wine for during their ceremony and for one full moon cycle after their nuptials. And
uh-huh.
This was thought to induce fertility and prosperity and wealth throughout their marriage. And back in the old days, the birth of sons. Yeah. I try to be more politically correct.
What can I tell you, Stephanie?
When describing it. And so that's where the legend of the honeymoon originated, was from this consumption of mead for the full moon cycle.
Well, you can obviously see that's a custom that has its modern-day versions, doesn't it?
It does.
Especially the whole thing of using the wedding as an occasion to get good and sort of lubricated for your future, in a sense.
Yes.
So do modern-day honeymooners respond to this when they come by on Kauai?
have so many honeymooners, and you know, anybody in my circle that gets married is sure to get at least a six pack of mead from me as a gift. So it's fun. It's fun to introduce couples to that tradition and bring them into the more modern styles that we create here.
So you're what, 13, 15 years along on this project?
Are you? Yes, I started in 2000 independently up in my garage, and the intent was to really start making a product that utilized our natural resources, added economic value to our honey and our fruit, and to support our small independent farmers and beekeepers and help them grow within the community.
Are you happy with how it's worked out for you, Stephanie?
Oh, it's doing so well. We've, since I've opened the business, I've learned so much more on the side of the importance of the honeybees and how, honey is produced within the bee community. I have several younger beekeepers that are now apprenticing under our old dogs, beekeepers here on Kauai. So, the community is expanding, and it's expanding in a good way. It's creating opportunity for our younger people to really find a place in the sustainable agricultural and apiary community here.
Great, Stephanie. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning, and good luck to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I look forward to meeting you when you come into town.
Absolutely. Stephanie Krieger is the owner of Nani Moon Meadery in Kapa'a, Kauai, and you can learn more about it at hpr2.org.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of two lovers who met on a train in Vienna in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Richard Linklater, and the stars, Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
You always know that a conversation is resonating when you hear other people in the hallway talking about it.
Uh-huh.
And a little earlier today, heard some of our guests already talking about the billing issue with hospitals. That really seems to rankle people and get under their skin.
Well, and it isn't that different from the cost of any other service, but because it's medical care, it has a special impact, obviously.
Well, it has a whole emotional component.
Sure.
And a lot of, shoulda, woulda, couldas attached to it.
It's also one of the most intense expenses you're ever going to meet in your life.
Particularly now, and why a lot of people are calling for more transparency. But how that happens, as George Green was trying to talk about, at least at this moment in time, is pretty difficult. And there are models around the country where they're trying to create more transparency. But how that is imported to Hawaii and what that looks like for us, right now they're pretty much in the how do we do it phase, not just we should do it.
Well, let's hope that process accelerates in the fairly near future.
Yeah, a lot of people are with you on that one. That's going to do it for us for the morning. But on tomorrow's agenda, should it be a major remodel or a teardown? We're going to talk with the Faith Action for Community Equity Director about what residents want for the Mayor Wright Housing Development Project.
And we'll talk with the president of an island nation that is moving towards sustainability.
Here's something that you like or that rankles you. Well, you can talk back to your radio on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation, or you can get me at BecauseHPR. Email is okay, too. That's talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR2 website, not coincidentally called HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and we'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.